Welcome to episode 36 of Rethinking with Alex Torpy. In this episode, I'm going to share a guest post that I wrote for the Together Across Differences Substack. And so about a month or two ago at the Vermont Town and City Management Association conference, there was a workshop that was put on by some folks from Braver Angels, a really interesting organization that does a lot of work to try and bridge divides between folks that are kind of more on the left and more on the right in the U.S. Beth Mallow was one of the people that was one of the moderators part of that conference, and we chatted afterwards and about all sorts of things, and one of them was kind of around how people kind of engage with what's around them and how their brains work or don't work, and especially talking about technology. Beth is a neurologist and has written a couple interesting books bringing together a few of these different perspectives. So the topic in this episode I've come across from a bunch of different angles in my own personal life, in my own professional life, in my teaching life. And so we thought it would be fun to write a guest post on their Substack. And she co-hosts that with Doug Techner, who used to serve in the legislature in New Hampshire and actually met when I was town manager in Hanover. So the article on the Substack, if you'd like to read it instead of listening to me talk about it, is called Reclaiming Focus in a Connected World. And I'm going to walk you through my article here. If you were to show Alexander Graham Bell, the inventor who secured the patent for the first basic telephone back in 1876, a modern smartphone in the 2020s, I think his expression probably wouldn't be one of awe and amazement, but of confusion or perhaps even horror. The device that he envisioned and where phones started was fundamentally different from the glass and metal rectangle that nearly 4.5 billion people in the world carry in their pockets today. The phone that originally was designed and that so many of us for actually over a century used was a destination. You had to physically go somewhere to use it. It was connected to a wall with a wire. You had to pick up the handset, dial a number, have a conversation, and then hang up with a really nice clang when you put the phone back on the receiver, and then you walked away. Using the phone was a very intentional act with very defined boundaries around it and a pretty unprecedented but narrow purpose. Today's smartphone couldn't be more different. It's really less of a communication tool, and especially for many people, especially many young people, it's not a tool that is used for having live voice conversations anymore, but it's really sort of a portal into many other worlds. It's a camera, it's a full-on computer, it's your connection point to all of the world's information, it's a calculator, it is, for some reason, how my insurance company wants to interact with me, and so many other things. This device hasn't just changed how we call people. And in fact, it's interesting to think about whether the ways that smartphones are designed and how they're used is a contributing factor to the decline of people actually using the phone as a phone to call people and have a live conversation. Rather, these devices have fundamentally altered how we think, how we pay attention, how our emotions work, and how we experience or don't experience being present. It has already changed and is still changing, and we're still just barely understanding how it's changing our actual brain chemistry. But like I argue with many things out in the world, we have a lot more agency here than we think we do, and we can be much more intentional about how we incorporate these devices into our lives. So what are these devices really? The way they work today, they more so mimic a slot machine than the phone that Alexander Graham Bell envisioned. And that slot machine corollary wasn't by accident. but rather it was a deliberate design choice made by very smart people who built the hardware and software that keeps us engaged. Instead of requiring coins and pulling a lever on chance, these devices provide intermittent variable rewards. These are dopamine hits disguised as likes and email notifications or breaking news alerts or other one of the many other push notifications that increasingly are not coming from other humans trying to contact you in that moment, but are coming from applications and services that are trying to get your attention. And our attention has become absolutely the most valuable commodity in our economic and political system today. With virtually every piece of technology now, from smartphones to TVs, to even modern vehicle infotainment centers that are remarkably distracting, they're all built around maximizing the extraction of that single resource, our attention. All of us have, without discussion or consent, traded deep focus for constant connectivity, sacrificing the quiet moments of boredom, which we have a pretty good understanding is one of the things that can lead to creative thinking. We've traded that for an endless feed of curated stimulation. We have sacrificed depth for breadth and quality for quantity. So how do we reclaim some sovereignty here? We can't uninvent these systems. The economic scaffolding supporting them is far too complex and deeply ingrained, and nor should we necessarily. I'm not arguing that these devices have no value. I actually think they can really offer a lot if they were used a little bit more intentionally, and perhaps in a better future if some of the hardware and software were designed differently with our values and our goals in mind, not the goals of basically advertisers who are the real customers of most of the services that we use, therefore making our attention the main commodity. So the idea here and the five different tips that I want to cover in this episode is to shift from being a user downstream reacting to the technology to architects who choose and design how we use the technology. We choose how to engage. So here's five fairly easy ways to start building a little bit of a better boundary about this in your own life. And by doing so, I think there is tremendous value that we're starting to see studied better and better. There's tremendous value in our emotional regulation, how we're being present, our nervous system regulation, unlocking creative potential, and all sorts of other things. So tip number one is to introduce some intentional friction. So one of the most insidious features that is, of course, billed as a benefit to us is the low barrier of entry to using it. Face ID, which means you just have to look at your phone to be able to unlock it, makes using the device effortless and nearly automatic. The fix here is really easy. Increase the friction a little bit. Just turn off Face ID. You don't need to use that. It didn't exist until fairly recently, and we had smartphones that were fairly convenient before that. Set a longer PIN or password. If accessing the device requires 3 seconds of conscious effort to type out a 6 or 8 digit PIN rather than just looking at it, you create a tiny cognitive speed bump. That 3 second pause is often enough to let you ask yourself, do I really need this right now? You'll find more often than not the answer is no. And I know from my own personal experience from doing that and trading Face ID for a longer PIN that there are times when I will type the PIN in incorrectly and then I just give up. I just don't really need to look at the phone and I kind of realize, oh, wait a second, I don't actually really need to look at this right now. So introducing a little bit of friction and recognizing that the lack of friction with Face ID or something like that, like some biometric access to your device, is not really for you, It's really a way to make it easier for you to use that device on a more regular basis, which may or may not be something that you actually want. Tip number two is to define physical tech zones, especially in your home. So we really need to stop treating our phones as ambient accessories that are just with us everywhere, in the bathroom, at the dinner table, in the bedroom. Our environment needs to be more intentional, and we really should have designated areas without digital devices. And so again, the practice here is actually relatively simple. And for those of you in the mid-millennial generation and older, this will all actually sound really familiar. Treat your home like it had a desktop computer and dial-up internet. Certain zones don't have technology, and certain zones do have technology. So reclaim this. The dining table is for eating and for human connection. Your bed is an analog sanctuary, reserved for sleep, not for scrolling. Creating these physical boundaries will help rewire our brains to associate those spaces with focus rather than with distraction. So one thing that I've tried recently with some success. So I purchased a set of cordless phones that have Bluetooth built into them. And when I enter my house or get near it, my personal smartphone connects to that device. Now, if I want to do something without my smartphone, but I want the ability to basically either make an emergency call or receive potentially an important call, but not necessarily do anything else with my phone, I take the cordless phone with me. This might be, you know, working on things outside, sleeping, taking a sauna. There's a whole bunch of activities where it'd be nice to be able to dial 911 if something were to come up. And it would also be nice to know if my phone is ringing from a call or from multiple calls. But I don't need anything else. And so what these Bluetooth cordless phones do is they basically act like a Bluetooth headset. There's no texting, there's no push notifications. You can simply make a call or receive a call. And there are a bunch of these devices out there. You can actually buy them at Staples and Best Buy and Amazon, you know, any place that you might buy electronics. Tip number three, curate the alerts. Don't let them curate you. The default notification settings are designed specifically to just scream for your attention, regardless of whether the thing is actually important or whether it's necessary or whether it's time sensitive. And again, this is because capturing our attention is a multi-billion dollar industry. And we have all implicitly opted into that by basically carrying a little device around that is a way for companies to notify us when they want to get our attention. And that is not something that I personally consented to. So go through your phone and audit some of your main applications, especially ones that send you notifications. And ask the simple question, if this app sends me a notification at 10 p.m., is it something that requires my immediate awareness? If the answer is no, just turn off the push notifications on the device. And there's a bunch of different layers to this, because it's not only about the push notifications, it's about does the phone show how many notifications that you have on that particular application on your home screen. So another thing that you can do is move some of those apps off your home screen. This is something that's always been odd to me, especially about iOS specifically versus Android, is how messy the home screens are, where it just adds new applications to the home. I mean, people's iPhone home screens are very anxiety-inducing for me. I like having things in folders and organized a little bit, and I don't want to have a really busy home screen. Basically, on my phone, it only has a couple of the things that I use on a very regular basis. And additionally, I spend a lot of time on my phone on Do Not Disturb. And that is because I can choose to look at my phone at any time. You can use a smartphone. You can have a smartphone and use it on a regular basis without constantly getting bombarded with notifications. Whether you turn off many of them for different applications or whether you put the whole thing on Do Not Disturb and you create some exceptions. Either way, there is the ability for all of us as users with these devices to make our decision about when to look at the device instead of the device deciding when we should look at it. Tip number four, re-embrace some unproductive analog time. So there is this modern compulsion to fill every second of every day with productivity. Oh, you're waiting in line? Scroll for something. Oh, you're waiting for your coffee to be done? Check your email. This is cognitively and emotionally exhausting. I don't think people appreciate how exhausting it really is to be this connected into so many different things. Our attention spans and our ability to have an attention span suffer because we don't practice the art of not doing things anymore. So one of the ways to do something about this is to schedule times of boredom without devices. When you're waiting in line, look at the architecture in the building or make up stories about the people around you. If you're outside walking, look at the trees, count the different shades of green, look at how many leaves are on each branch. Just do something that allows your brain to engage with a slower activity rather than these sort of like hyper stimulation of looking at something on your phone. And by intentionally redirecting your focus onto the immediate physical world, you'll start to retrain your brain a little bit to find richness in low stimulation environments and start to reset some of these dopamine pathways that have been so overly used and pressured in our lives today. And remember, nobody lived like this. No human lived with this level of stimulation more than, 20, 25 years ago. All of human history before that, all of the amazing things that humans have done and invented and created, and all these artistic works and scientific and engineering achievements, those were all done in environments without the constant distraction that we have today. So for many years, I think many of you know, I taught in a Master of Public Administration program at Seton Hall University in South Orange. And each year, what I began the semester with was a class about attention and distraction. We talked about this a little bit and just made sure to reframe how our economic system works and how a lot of these things vie for our attention. And I provided students some information and encouraged them to try doing some of the coursework without a device interrupting them. So that when they would go to do work on this assignment, and a lot of the coursework was meant to be deep creative thinking about long-term big picture things, which is hard to do. It's hard to think. It's hard when you're working on something that's hard to think about and you have a distraction right in your pocket that is low barrier and high dopamine reward. It is very hard to force yourself to actually sit through the thing, figure out the thing, and think through all of that. Again, when you have something you can just reach for. And so each year, we talk about it conceptually and I provide people a bunch of different sort of takeaways, like a few in this episode. And each year I would have students just remark that this was a totally different way for them to do their schoolwork, was to take their phone, and put it in their sock drawer in their bedroom for an hour while they work on a paper or while they're reading something for the class. And I've spent a lot of time disconnected from technology. I have lived in areas with bad cell phone service or bad Wi-Fi, so sometimes I didn't have a choice. I've also traveled a lot in remote and rural areas where there wasn't cell phone service, wasn't any internet. And especially, for example, when I drove across the country a few years back, spent a few, 5, 6, 7 day periods of time with my phone turned off. And the number of creative kind of projects and thinking that I was able to do from that was amazing. And when your brain can't just reach for a dopamine hit nearby, it starts to do other things that are really valuable. One of the things that was really valuable on this trip that I'll share with you was something that I had talked about with my therapist at the time, which was all this stuff is on my mind and wanting to sort of reclaim. I remember the time before all of these smartphones and devices, just barely. And I really want to regain some of that agency, obviously why I'm kind of talking about these things. And so one of the things that we decided to do was that I would have what we called a day of nothing. And so I was in Utah at the time in Dixie National Forest. And what I did was spend in, you know, basically a waking up to going to sleep day without doing anything. I was allowed to make food to eat, but not really like cook, like, you know, doing something fun with a bunch of ingredients. I was allowed to clean up from that, but I couldn't like do a big cleanup. And I could walk around, but I couldn't take a hike, like where you're really engaged and going for a really cool view. So, you know, it was a long day, especially when you're, you know, camping. At least for me, I often wake up pretty early. And so, you know, spent a solid 16 hours doing nothing. And I ended up, you know, no reading, no writing, just kind of sitting and walking around a little bit. And it was actually really interesting. It was a little difficult, but it allowed my brain a little bit of space to actually figure a couple things out that I had been reflecting on sort of in the back of my mind. And so it was really valuable. It kind of unlocks by taking away the ability for your brain to get a quick dopamine hit, you unlock another level of your brain, which is pretty cool. One other kind of example that I'll mention is years ago, this was maybe 2017, 2018, something like that. I took a vacation, which I had not taken a big block of time off in a little while. And I went out to California. I'd rented a motorcycle, and I was going to spend, I think it was ended up being about 5 or 6 days riding the motorcycle around California and Nevada. And I did not... I was not on my phone for any of that time. I did have a phone with me, and I did use it twice. I checked in with my parents once, where I had an email account. Basically, this was not my regular smartphone. It was like an old smartphone that I took with me and popped the SIM card in, had one email account that I used to just send an email midway through and just say, hey, everything's okay. And then I did use it once to look at the weather when I was, out in, basically in the desert at one point, and there appeared to be a rainstorm coming in, and, flash flooding in the desert is pretty serious. And especially if you can imagine if you're on a motorcycle, even more serious. So those were the two times I used the device throughout the week. And the rest of the time I was navigating with a paper map, that I had folded up, and again, I was camping most of the night, so I had all this camp, my tent and all the stuff packed on the back of the motorcycle. And I would just pull up into diners and gas stations and pull the map out, and people were definitely giving me some weird looks. And I basically traced my route, you know, it ended up being about 1,000 miles of riding. And I, you know, did that whole route just by using the paper map. But the kind of interesting thing about it was, you know, I like doing photography and things like that. Right. But one of the weird things is when you're traveling and you're taking pictures and posting them on social media or sharing them with people while you're doing the traveling. And what I had found from, you know, just sort of doing that the way that a lot of people do that previously is that the sort of like I could feel a little bit of anxiety coming up about posting something on social media. Am I getting enough likes? You know, is X person liking it? Is Y person liking it? You know, is the picture, did I take the picture the right way? All those sort of like intrusive thoughts that start coming up, part of the anxiety of using social media the way that it's designed. And I wanted to take pictures and like share them because it was kind of a cool trip and I was seeing some cool places. I was out in Death Valley and Joshua Tree and just like really just cruising out through these like really desert areas, the Mojave Desert, you know, on a motorcycle. It's just really cool. I wanted to share that stuff. But I didn't want to take away from the trip. And so this is such a basic thing. And last example and kind of point number four here, but it was to take all the pictures I wanted, but not share any of them until I was back. And then the next week, I shared the pictures basically at the same times that I took them the week before. And so I got the best of both worlds, right? I got to travel and take really cool pictures of like the night sky and like cool desert scenes and stuff. And it's like really adorable little coyote that was like in the middle of the road. And it's one of my favorite pictures I've taken that has these huge mountains in the background, taken with like a very zoomed in like telephoto lens. And so I got to experience all of that and be present during those experiences. And I got to share those experiences with people without the sharing of those experiences with people undermining the being present in the actual experience. So I think that's just kind of a cool example that we don't have to give everything up here with these devices and technology. We just have to figure out a way to sort of regulate them a little bit better. And so tip number five is to compartmentalize technology's function a little bit. So when you need a timer for something, maybe don't use the phone. Maybe use your watch or a kitchen timer. I know when I'm cooking, I always use the bevel timer on my watch because I know that if I use the timer on my phone, if I just want to cook and just hang out, once I pick up the phone, if I see notifications, or even just picking up the device, it's been well studied that it doesn't matter if it's on Do Not Disturb or if it's turned upside down, just our brain's awareness, being able to feel the phone in our pocket or see the device within our eye line, starts generating some of the cognitive processes like related to FOMO, the fear of missing out. The other thing is often like I will use my computer instead of my phone. I will sit at my desk and write the email instead of using my phone, you know, while I'm outside. And so one of the things that we can do is kind of compartmentalize which things we're actually using our phone for. Do we really need to be using the smartphone for that? Are there dedicated apps on the phone to use for certain things, or do we not want to use the phone at all? And so I think that's really important as well. So those are five tips of sort of resetting your relationship with your devices. You can introduce some intentional friction by disabling biometric and Face ID and using a password or a PIN that's longer. You can define zones in your home especially, or even your workplace potentially, where you have technology and where you don't use technology. Pretend your phone is a wired desktop computer. Number three is that you can choose when to look at your device, not when your device wants you to look at it, by curating alerts, by turning off notifications, by using Do Not Disturb. Number four is to re-embrace and really see the value of non-digital analog time in all sorts of different aspects of our lives. And number five is really be intentional about why we're using a particular, why we need the phone for a particular function. And if there are other analog things like a kitchen timer or a watch instead. So each of these adjustments are just small acts of rebellion against an attention economy that is intentionally designed to keep us perpetually engaged, primarily for the profit making of large companies who care nothing about our mental health or our wellness. Making any of these changes or all of these changes won't solve the deep structural issues of global tech dependence, but they will help you be more of the conductor of your own attention span again, just like it was for all of human history up until 20 or 25 years ago. And who knows, with that added attention and focus and creativity, maybe that will each help us to have more capacity to make our workplaces and communities and societies better.